Chapter 34. Based on her extensive research in the 1970s for her book Kilgallen, author Lee Israel believed one person was responsible for Kilgallen's death. She wrote, "It must be considered probably that if Dorothy was murdered, the crime was done to silence her by a kiss-and-tell representative of whatever faction it is that did not want the facts about the JFK assassination to emerge." Concerning the kiss-and-tell observation, it normally relates to a person who, without permission, shares romantic exploits, especially those of a sexual nature, with others. Israel's reference to whatever faction may be interpreted to mean Israel believed Kilgallen's death was connected to someone who could not permit her extensive JFK and Oswald assassination investigation evidence to be exposed, arguably in the book she was writing for Random House. Taking this a step further, Kilgallen's fatal mistake was in all likelihood boasting to so many people. Bold statements like, "I'm going to crack this case wide open," while not just investigating the assassinations in New Orleans once, but planning a second trip, one the representative of whatever faction could not let her take. And thus, she was killed before visiting that city again. Targeting the logical suspect who betrayed Dorothy Kilgallen by leaking details of her JFK and Lee Harvey Oswald assassination investigation to those fearing disclosure requires close attention to her inner circle. Is there someone with whom she had a romantic relationship who might have been the kiss-and-tell representative Israel mentions? This Judas, whoever he was, needed to earn Kilgallen's trust in order to learn secrets about both her private life and her professional career. Since she was not one to confide in too many people, it had to be a relationship that was special to her. The relationship had to be genuine, at least to her, although there were times, at least a few, when she had been buffaloed by those seeking to use her so as to enhance career aspirations. Most times, Kilgallen spotted the phonies, but there were exceptions, especially people she trusted who turned out not to be friends. Those in Kilgallen's inner sanctum as of November 1965 were few. James and Evelyn Clement and their children Brenda and Larry, Richard, hairdressers Mark Sinclair and Charles Simpson, family companion and tutor Ibn Hassan, friends Bob and Jean Bach, Marlon Swing, actress Joan Crawford, and Johnny Ray. Kilgallen's fellow panelists on What's My Line were certainly friends, as was host John Charles Daly, but they were not considered close friends. Curiously, the only new member of Kilgallen's inner circle appeared shortly after she covered the Jack Ruby trial. He was also her companion as she continued her JFK and Oswald assassination investigations. His name was Ron Pataki, actual name Adam Ronald Pataki, the new love in the famous journalist's life a year and a half before her death. As of the printing of this book, he is still alive and living in Columbus, Ohio, but long retired from the newspaper business. As will be revealed, Pataki has denied any culpability for Kilgallen's death, but substantial evidence points in another direction. Pataki, by all accounts, was Kilgallen's second and only extramarital affair after Johnny Ray. During his videotaped interview, Mark Sinclair did not try to excuse Kilgallen's having affairs with both men. The only mention of this matter was when Sinclair stated, "Dorothy was lonely, really lonely," an apparent reference to the discord in her marriage with Richard, including the absence of any sexual relations. Important to note is that Pataki, 29, was 22 years younger than Kilgallen, 51, when he met her in June 1964, 3 months after the Ruby trial. She had been quite the busy columnist prior to this time. One exclusive column entitled "Hope Makes a Bid to Beatles" began with the words, "Bob Hope is offering the Beatles a fabulous fee to appear in one of his next flickers. Other celebrities mentioned in the column included Joan Crawford, Audrey Hepburn, and Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh. In addition, she had penned a column entitled, "Shirley MacLaine Has Eye on Funny Girl," referring to MacLaine's interest in starring with Frank Sinatra in the film version of the successful play. Consensus appears to be that Kilgallen and Pataki, who had earned a degree in journalism from Ohio State University in 1959, before becoming the film and drama critic for the Columbus Citizen Journal in 1961, met during a 20th Century Fox European press junket for three upcoming films. They were The Sound of Music, The Agony and the Ecstasy, and Those Magnificent Men in Their Flying Machines. Kilgallen attracted as much attention as the movie stars did during the junket. They included Charlton Heston and Julie Andrews. Her Journal American colleague Louis Sobel said Kilgallen called Heston Chuckles. He called her Dotty. A Canadian Broadcasting Network crew from the program This Hour Has 7 Days joined the junket, and 7 months later, on January 10, 1965, it aired a segment including interviews with several of the three films' stars, including Andrews, Heston, Rex Harrison, and Sarah Miles. Kilgallen is on camera several times and also interviewed regarding time spent with Heston. Lurking in the background is Ron Pataki as he takes photos of Julie Andrews. Video is available at the DorothyKilgallenStory.org. Bustling with excitement, Kilgallen wrote in her Journal American column about the terrific reception she received in London. "Since I've been in Europe for 4 days, not keeping up with the newspapers at all, I don't know how things were going at the United Nations, but I could testify that as of this minute in London, British-US relations seemed to be better than ever in history. The sun was smiling on England when I landed at London Airport, and the Londoners were smiling on the Americans." She then added two examples of how well the trip was progressing. The first read, "At the airport, Ron Pataki, the Columbus Citizen Journal columnist, invited me to ride into town with him. He said to the cab driver, 'I haven't any pounds with me. Would you take American money?' The hacky grinned. 'Hop in, governor,' he said. 'It's the best money in the world.' She followed up with, 'When I reached the Savoy Hotel and my luggage was sent up, I quickly pulled out a little black dress, suitable for an evening on the town, and rang for a valet.' He smiled and said, 'You can have anything you wish, miss,' taking the dress as tenderly as if it were one of Queen Elizabeth's robes." Through the years, Pataki provided varying versions of when Kilgallen and he first met and what transpired from June 1964 until Kilgallen died some 17 months later. According to Pataki, the first encounter happened in Salzburg, Austria, not London, on the set of The Sound of Music. Pataki said Kilgallen tripped while entering a bus and he caught her, whereupon she acted flirtatiously, leading to drinks together at a local restaurant. Pataki's sturdy build and good looks had already captured the hearts of celebrity women, including Frank Sinatra's future wife, Mia Farrow, and Italian operatic singer and sultry actress, Anna Maria Alberghetti. Each had been younger than he was, but neither approached the 20-plus year age difference between he and Kilgallen. During the mid-2000s, Midwest Today publisher Larry Jordan told this author, he asked Pataki, during an audio-recorded interview, why he was attracted to Kilgallen, a woman much older. He replied, "For all of her brashness in print, she was very poetic. Dorothy was a dyed-in-the-wool romantic, to be sure, a very soft person. I never saw her angry. I don't think other than strictly business, something like discussing the Jack Ruby thing, Dorothy and I ever had a serious conversation. She was a sweet lady, my best friend in the whole world." From Kilgallen's point of view, interest from a man 2+ decades younger than she was must have fed her ego. Johnny Ray was 14 years younger and had succumbed to her charms and provided companionship and lust after Richard and she became little more than strangers. but having the ruggedly handsome Pataki, still in his 20s, interested in her from a romantic standpoint, must have been a real boost at a time when Richard ignored her sexual needs. Pataki, however, swore the year-and-a-half affair was platonic in nature. He said, "We'd shuck the rest of these phonies and go off and do our thing. And we made trips together. We went to Florence together. We went to London together in 1964. We'd kiss hello on the cheek if I was coming to town, New York City. But there was no goodnight kiss when I dropped her off, and I dropped her off a lot of times. Because it wasn't that kind of a relationship. Never. I had my girlfriends. She knew about them. We never, ever spent any time in a hotel room." Based on her research, author Lee Israel, among others to be noted, disagreed, writing, "In her girlish fiction, Dorothy May could not have fantasized a more romantic ambiance for a love affair." She added that the two walked the streets of Florence enjoying each other's company as they surveyed the historical landscape. Mark Sinclair certainly questioned Pataki's version of his relationship with the famous columnist. In early 1965, Sinclair recalled daughter Jill, married at the time, visited the townhouse. Pinpointing minute details, the hairdresser stated in his videotaped interview, "It was chilly, because Jill had a sweater on and she was very angry. I was doing Dorothy's hair when she walked in from the service entrance and stood in the corner. She leaned against the dresser and stared at Dorothy. She and I were surprised the way Jill stormed into the room with venom in her voice and eyes." According to Sinclair, Jill confronted her mother, the trading of accusations in loud voices echoing through the townhouse. The hairdresser said Jill was very angry. She mentioned Pataki by name and said she was highly infuriated because her mother was going out with this man and sleeping with him all over town. Jill added, according to Sinclair, "It's just too embarrassing to be seen in public with you." When Jill left, Sinclair said Kilgallen cried. Then she said, "I don't know why Jill wants to behave this way. She knows about her father and his indiscretions. I've told her. And she knows a lot of other things. I will never see Jill again in public." "And she never did," Sinclair added. "They were never able to patch things up before she died." In an audio-taped interview, Sinclair explained the Kilgallen-Jill confrontation nearly verbatim to the videotaped version of the story. He added, among other details, that the confrontation had taken place a week or 3 or 4 weeks before Kilgallen died, before all this with Pataki started to bubble over. What he meant by bubble over will become clear. Sinclair said the argument became so heated he excused himself from fixing Kilgallen's hair. Kilgallen's friend Marlon Swing also was aware of the argument. How Jill learned of her affair her mother was having with Pataki is unknown. In his videotaped interview, Sinclair, who said Pataki wanted to keep the affair very quiet, speculated on where the couple may have rendezvoused. He said, "There were several places Kilgallen could have gone with Pataki. One was my apartment, and there was interior designer Howard Rothberg's house. She could have gone to either. She had a key to my apartment, and she had a key to his, Rothberg's." On one occasion, Sinclair asked Kilgallen, "Why are you going to a hotel?" She told him, "He, Pataki, wants to." This disputes Pataki's claim the couple never went to hotel rooms. The Regency was where Pataki, the only other person besides Johnny Ray whom she trusted with the unlisted Kloop telephone number, resided when he was in New York City. Sinclair recalled Kilgallen calling Pataki from the Kloop. When asked if Kilgallen's phones were tapped, Sinclair replied, "I think they were tapped, but I don't know how much she was using them for her investigation. I think she was using her phones to talk to Ron Pataki. But that was the phone up in the Kloop. She slept there, and she spent a lot of time there. She was alone there. She didn't let anyone near her." Interviews at thedorothykilgallenstory.org. The woman who handled room assignments at the Regency reported Kilgallen had booked the room for Pataki, stating, "The keys were given to her, Sinclair confirmed this fact in his interview. I know she met Ron there. They kept a room upstairs that she would go to. They often met there. A note discovered, from Kilgallen to Pataki, was romantically themed, mentioning our little room on the 19th floor. By all accounts, it was at the Regency, now Lowe's Regency at 540 Park Avenue in New York City. Asked in his videotaped interview whether Pataki had a romantic streak, Mark Sinclair answered, Pataki gave her notes and cards. I don't know about flowers. Once he sent her some cutout valentines, and they all strung apart, which she showed me. Kilgallen's friend Marlon Swing said of their relationship, she was like a little girl after her first date, going on about how they'd met, how marvelous he was, the moonlight and the clouds and the poetry he had recited to her. It was obvious that he had become very important. Kilgallen's letters to Pataki are quite revealing. One, signed in Kilgallen's handwriting, reads, Wednesday morning. See the picture of me with two guys, taken at the Regency? Notice that they were the wrong guys to be at the Regency with. Where were you when I wanted you? D. Kilgallen, using the words, I wanted you, is subject to interpretation, but suggests she had intimacy on her mind. For certain, the letter typed under Dorothy Colmar instead of Kilgallen, a rarity, points to a previous rendezvous between the couple at the Regency Hotel. A longer letter, written September 22, 1965, less than 2 months before Kilgallen was murdered, is more revealing. It reads, Wednesday. Dear sweetie, the John Gary item is in this column, which I finally unearthed. More copies coming when 007 can get into the JA building. Dig this French letter paper, which I bought in Switzerland. Is it not too Kim Novak for words? I tried to get the name in white, but with stubborn Swiss efficiency, they told me it was impossible. I don't think it was, but I'm not very good at arguing with a dame who speaks nothing but German. I'll try to phone you soon, hopefully before you get this, but it ain't easy. I miss you. But could you try to make your New York trip in late October or early November? Then I'll have more time for conferences and all that jazz. Tonight is Arlene's opening. I dread the thought. But I have to make the scene, and Ralph Meeker is giving a party afterwards, and since he lives just around the corner from us, there's no excuse for not catching a few minutes of that. I have 5 song titles and a few lyrics. What are you, contagious or something? Well, you're certainly, or something. Kisses. D. Notice Kilgallen's use of the intimate words sweetie and kisses, and her admitting, I miss you. When shown the letters, Pataki dismissed any notion of romantic intent, explaining that there was no reference to his body or any sexual relationship. When Pataki was asked his whereabouts on the day Kilgallen died, he stated, I was in Columbus, Ohio, in my office, at 8 in the morning. That's where I was horrified to receive the news of Dorothy's death. With the newspaper city room utterly jammed with witnesses, all of whom knew Dorothy from her visits to my office. Moreover, phone records from Columbus placed me here until well past midnight that night. Pataki also swore his mother was the first one who told him of Kilgallen's death, and that he wasn't in New York City until 2 or 3 weeks after she died. Further, he said that a fashion editor named Jane Horrocks read the sad news of Kilgallen's death from the newspaper newswire to him at the office. This proved impossible due to a letter this author reviewed, where Horrocks, known as Jane Kerrer at the time, stated she was in California on November 8, 1965, the day Kilgallen died, covering fashion showings. Midwest Today publisher Larry Jordan said Pataki became belligerent when questioned about his whereabouts. Pataki then stated, the next day, Monday, I had been in my office in Columbus, Ohio from 8 o'clock on, before asking, what did I do? Hire my own jet, fly to New York, kill her, and then fly back in a hurry? Without having been accused of wrongdoing. Kilgallen's friend, Bob Bach, the What's My Line associate producer, said Kilgallen told him, while they were at P.J. Clark's on the 7th, she had a late date, and that he was under the impression the date was with Ron Pataki. The reason, Bach explained, there was no one else at that time who she would have called a date. That the late date was at the Regency Hotel where Pataki stayed adds credence to Bach's assumption. A closer look at the September 22nd letter from Kilgallen to Pataki mentions her requesting that he visit New York City at the end of October or early November, proving her invitation squared up with the time during which she was killed. In yet another interview, Pataki, who stated Kilgallen could sometimes be easily duped by those who wanted to use her for personal gain, said that his best memory was that we talked the night before Dorothy died, since we usually called on the weekends. Regarding the phone conversation, Pataki added, "The last time we spoke, she was in great spirits. When you lose someone close to you, you remember that. She was all right with the world." Pataki also mentioned the call during his interview with Larry Jordan, but suggested it happened during the wee hours of November 8th at approximately 12:30 a.m., which would have happened just before Kilgallen arrived at the Regency Hotel bar. During an interview with Lee Israel, he pegged the time as 2:30 a.m. Either time frame appears dubious, since there is no indication she had spoken to Pataki after rushing from the What's My Line appearance to P.J. Clark's and then to the Regency Hotel bar. There were no cell phones or smartphones in those days, meaning Kilgallen would have had to use a public phone, arguably at the Regency, to locate Pataki since he could not call her. While their speaking at that time could have happened, it is likely Pataki was telling another of his half-truths or outright lies. During the call, if there was one, Pataki swore she was not suicidal, that she was just normal. She always called herself my New York secretary and Susie Cream Cheese. The latter name was fictitious, apparently invented by the 1960s rock group Mothers of Invention, featuring Frank Zappa, for a particular underage groupie shared by several members of the group during a concert stop on Maui in 1966. It was certainly not complimentary toward Kilgallen. Not only is it suspect whether Kilgallen would have associated herself with such a derogatory name, but Pataki mentioning Kilgallen using that name would have been impossible, since she died in 1965, a year before the Maui experience. Whether Pataki lied about the use of Susie Cream Cheese aside, he also admitted, according to Jordan, to circulating in the underworld, to knowing mobsters, including Sam Giancana. Asked to be more specific, Pataki said, "I knew Sam Giancana through singer Phyllis McGuire. Drunk one night, I tried to put the make on her. That didn't work." This encounter apparently happened when Phyllis appeared at the Kenley Players Summer Theater in Columbus, Ohio, in the musical comedy Little Me. This recently discovered newspaper photo from September 1, 1964, during the time when the Warren Commission report was being released, confirms her presence, with it being noteworthy that the Phyllis McGuire photo is positioned directly to the left of Pataki's music and theater column. In a column written 15 days later, he wrote, "You'll love Phyllis McGuire. She is singing her numbers beautifully. I can truthfully say that I enjoyed Little Me more than any Kenley production of the entire summer." Efforts by this author to interview Phyllis McGuire, twice by letter to her Las Vegas home, the second including a copy of The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, and through a telephone call, fell on deaf ears. The impetus for contacting the former member of the McGuire sisters, popular singers with such hits as Sincerely, Sugar Time, also the HBO title of a film about Phyllis and Giancana she attempted to block from being released, and All I Have to Do Is Dream, stems from a Vanity Fair article written by Dominic Dunn. Phyllis was quoted as saying she considered Kilgallen's death to be suspicious, and that she knew something about it. According to a CIA file entitled CIA Inspector General's Report on Plots to Assassinate Fidel Castro, Kilgallen was friendly with Phyllis McGuire. The account read, "Johnny Roselli, mafia associate of Sam Giancana, found himself facing a table at ringside at which Phyllis McGuire was sitting with Dorothy Kilgallen and Liberace for the opening night of singer Rosemary Clooney. Pataki's relationship with McGuire aside, he did not attend Kilgallen's funeral. This decision was made despite his having called her a wonderful, wonderful friend, as well as my very best friend.